Israeli forces once again stormed Al-Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza as the regime's unrelenting airstrikes claim more civilian lives throughout the besieged enclave. The top UN court holds a fifth day of public hearings on Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territories. And people in New York hold yet another rally against the U.S. government for supporting Israel's genocide in Gaza. Now, Israel has struck several residential buildings in central Gaza, killing at least 40 people and injuring over 100 others. City of Deir al-Balah and the town of Zuweida were latest targets of the regime's air raids. Airstrikes also hit the southern city of Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have sought shelter. Gaza's health ministry says the Israeli troops once again stormed Al-Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis after a brief withdrawal. They surrounded the facility, preventing entry or exit of medical staff and civilians. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says it's managed to evacuate some 51 patients from the hospital, but 140 others are still stranded there.
WHO so far conducted 3 high-risk missions into Nasser Hospital and managed to evacuate 51 patients to the hospitals in the south, but we still have around 140 patients remaining in the hospital. Those figures unfortunately change on every hour basis because of the hostilities. Some patients leave themselves. A lot of patients remain in the hospital, but some patients also unfortunately succumb to the wounds that because they went to the hospital.
World Body said it will try to evacuate the critically ill and critically wounded from Al-Nasser and other medical centers in the south, including in Rafah. For the past 4 months, Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has killed over 29,500 Palestinians, most of them women and children, and has injured over 70,000 others. Head of the international charity group Doctors Without Borders has denounced the U.S. for vetoing U.N. Security Council resolutions for a ceasefire in Gaza. Christopher Lockyer has also criticized Security Council itself for its failure to address the crisis in Gaza. He was speaking at a Security Council meeting on Thursday. Here he is.
We are appalled by the willingness of the United States to use its powers as a permanent council member to obstruct efforts to adopt the most evident of resolutions, one demanding an immediate and sustained ceasefire. 3 times this council has had an opportunity to vote for the ceasefire that is so desperately needed, and 3 times the United States has used its veto power, most recently this Tuesday. We, along with the world, are closely watching how this council and its members have approached the conflict in Gaza. Meeting after meeting, resolution after resolution, this body has failed to effectively address this conflict. We have watched members of this council deliberate and delay while civilians die. A new draft resolution by the United States ostensibly calls for a ceasefire. However, this is misleading at best. This council should reject any resolution that further hampers humanitarian efforts on the ground and leads this council to tacitly endorse the continued violence and mass atrocities in Gaza. There are not enough hospital beds, there are not enough medications, and not enough supplies. Surgeons have had no choice but to carry out amputations without anesthesia on children. Our surgeons are running out of basic gauze to stop their patients from bleeding. They use it once, squeeze out the blood, wash it, sterilize it, and reuse it for the next patient. The people of Gaza need a ceasefire not when practicable, but now. They need a sustained ceasefire, not a temporary period of calm. Anything short of this is gross negligence.
The Israeli regime carried out a drone strike on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, killing 2 Palestinians. The violence has been escalating in the West Bank ever since the Gaza war broke out, with Israeli forces intensifying the raids throughout the occupied territory. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Moni Kandil, joined us earlier with the details.
The Israelis carried out a drone strike against a vehicle. Inside this vehicle, There were at least four Palestinians. Yasser Hanoun was killed in this operation. The three others that were inside the vehicle were seriously wounded, according to paramedics. At least 11 others were wounded, were in the area inside Jenin refugee camp, including at least 5 children. They were playing outside their homes when the drone strike against the vehicle have taken place. Later, as you have mentioned, Palestinian Ministry of Health said that 17-year-old Palestinian Saeed Jaradat succumbed to his injuries in the Jenin hospital. So we are speaking about 2 Palestinians have been killed in this drone strike. 14 others were wounded, including at least 4 are in serious or 3 are in serious condition, and 4 others are Palestinian children who have been wounded in this drone strike. It's clear that even if the Israeli forces do not kill or arrest Palestinians, we can say that every day the Israeli forces are raiding Jenin city and its refugee camp, or at least the areas around the refugee camp, and cause severe destruction.
Meanwhile, thousands of people have taken to the streets of New York City in a Jewish-led rally to condemn genocide in Gaza and U.S. support for it.
I'm deeply saddened and devastated that our country is enabling this violence in the Middle East. And as an American and as a Jewish woman, I feel like it has to stop, and that we're not going to find any other solutions until we stop the bombing. And especially in light of the number of innocent people, especially children, being destroyed every day, I find it really demoralizing right now to be part of a country that's allowing this to happen.
I'm here today as not only as an American Jew, but as a combat veteran who is now an anti-war activist, among other things, to speak out against AIPAC and, in a larger scope, Zionism, and how it misrepresents Judaism. And my demand is for U.S. politicians to cut ties with AIPAC and to get more serious about what their contingents say than what AIPAC has to say, as far as demanding a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, as a beginning toward a liberated Palestine.
Now, protesters marched to the headquarters of the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. They blamed it for funding the genocide in Gaza. The demonstrators renewed their calls for a ceasefire. At least a dozen were arrested during Thursday's protests. It was the latest in New York City in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Other American cities have also witnessed similar protests on numerous occasions since the Gaza war broke out in early October. Protesters have poured onto the streets of the northern Yemeni city of Sada'a in yet another rally in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. Yemeni protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans against Israel and its main supporter, the U.S. They've been holding rallies on Friday since the Gaza war broke out. The Yemenis held pictures of their leaders in a show of support for their pro-Palestine operations, which include targeting Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea in an effort to pressure the regime into stopping its genocide in Gaza. The Yemeni protesters also voiced support for their army's operations against U.S. and U.K. warships in response to their ongoing airstrikes on Yemen. Those airstrikes began in the wake of the Yemeni attacks on Israeli vessels in the Red Sea. The top UN court is to convene for 5th day of public hearings on Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territories. Representatives from a number of countries and several international organizations present their stances on Israeli occupation at the International Court of Justice. During the court sessions held in previous days, many countries condemned Israel's apartheid against Palestinians. They underlined Palestinians reserve the right to self-determination. The Palestinian envoy to the UN also made his case at the Hague-based court. Riyad Mansour said international law has failed so far to stop Israel from committing crimes against the Palestinians. The hearings began Monday and will end on the 26th of February. Oral proceedings are related to a case brought by the UN General Assembly following a resolution passed in December 2022.
On Thursday, the International Court of Justice held its fourth day of hearings on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. The case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, when the international organization passed a resolution requesting an advisory opinion from the ICJ on Israel's policies and practices in the West Bank and in East Al-Quds, with a focus on the legal consequences arising from depriving the Palestinians from self-determination. 52 nations and three organizations, namely the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League, and African Union, are taking part in the hearings.
Well, I think what we're witnessing today is a public triad. Country after country is exposing the evilness of occupation, is showing the tremendous violation of human rights that occupation continues to commit day in and day out, and it's also addressing the inhumane barbaric war that Israel continues to bring upon Gaza.
Iran and China were among those countries addressing the ICJ hearing on Thursday. Outside the court, braving the Hague's cold temperature, tens of people from across the Netherlands held a demonstration in solidarity with Palestinians.
I personally believe that the fact that it's not legally binding doesn't matter. I don't think this court case is necessarily going to be the direct reason that the Palestinian people will be liberated. I think it will be the pressure on our governments and international community that will hopefully make justice prevail.
Millions of people across the world are watching this case at the International Court of Justice. They are hoping that their faith in an international law-based system can be finally restored after decades of Israel subjecting the Palestinians to discrimination, apartheid, and deadly military force, and evading accountability. Max Civili, The Hague.
It is election season in Iran, and campaigning has officially begun for two elections that will be held simultaneously. In about a week, Iranians will be going to the polls to elect members of parliament and also the Assembly of Experts. Yusuf Mishahmadi has your details.
The race for Iran's parliament has kicked off, with over 15,000 candidates competing for 290 seats of the 12th term of the Islamic Consultative Assembly, promising an exciting campaign to watch, considering that the Assembly of Experts, the directly elected body in charge of supervising and electing the leader, will be held simultaneously.
We have two very important elections ahead. It goes without saying that elections are at the core of our democracy, and people and the choices they make define the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the Constitutional Council, as a supervisory body, has an important responsibility. Vetting the candidates and providing the list of eligible hopefuls is a daunting task. It took us about 3 months, because this year over 20,000 parliamentary hopefuls registered, which is unprecedented. 15,343 were approved. This means that on average 53 candidates will be competing for every parliamentary seat. The competition is going to be quite fierce, with different political views represented. And as always, there are also a large number of independent candidates running.
Candidates were given the official go-ahead for their campaigning activities on February 22nd. But the road to the parliament is long, expensive, and exhausting. And becoming a candidate is only the beginning of the election process. Obtaining a place on the ballot depends very much on what happens on the campaign trail. And this time around, Iran's national television, IRIB, has stepped in to provide all candidates with equal opportunities. According to law, all campaigning activities must stop 24 hours before the elections. This means that candidates have to make the best of the 1 week they have ahead. The 12th parliamentary elections will be held simultaneously with the 6th election of the Assembly of Experts on Friday, March the 1st. And while many campaigning activities happen close to Election Day, most hopefuls have already laid the groundwork for their political campaigns with the platforms provided by Iran's national television, IRIB. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
And with that, we conclude your news bulletin, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on Imam Mehdi. A major opening to salvation is awaiting the reappearance of Imam Mehdi. June 11, 2014. We should wait. The outlook of religions towards the final destination of the caravan of mankind is a very promising outlook. The spirit of waiting and establishing a close relationship with the Imam of the time, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, and anticipating the day when he reappears is really one of the greatest gates of salvation, Faraj, for the Islamic community. We are waiting for salvation. This anticipation itself is salvation. This anticipating is the gate to salvation. It is promising and revitalizing. It prevents us from feeling desperate, ruined, hopeless, and confused about the future. It gives us hope and it provides guidance. This is the point about the Imam of the time. God's greetings be upon him.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Belief in the Savior is a component of religion's worldviews. June 11, 2014. Belief in the Imam of the time is a component of religion's worldviews. That is, just as divine religions hold viewpoints within their general worldviews about the universe, mankind, origin, and the end of human life's trajectory, about Genesis and resurrection, they also hold viewpoints in their worldviews about the final destination of the caravan of humans. A worldview is a great system which lays the foundation for all the thoughts, obligations, and rules of religions. It addresses the issues of the afterlife and the hereafter. Another issue is where mankind is heading to. If we liken the human community throughout history to a caravan which is taking a specific path, then we are faced with this question. Where is this caravan going? What is the destination of this caravan? What is the end of this path? This is a serious question, and every worldview should answer it. Religions have answered this question. All of them believe that this caravan will reach a favorable, sweet, and pleasant destination in the end. The main characteristic of this destination is justice. Justice has been humanity's general request from the first day until today, and it will remain mankind's main request until the end. Those people who try to believe in variety, diversity, and change in their principles and main philosophies cannot deny the fact that humanity has had certain requests from the first day until today, the most important of which is justice. Humanity is after justice. It has never changed its mind about this demand, and in the end, this demand will be met.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Face to face. Hello and welcome to another edition of Face to Face. I'm Mahdi Abbasian. Today in the studio, we are joined by one of the members of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement, Mr. Osama Hamdan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hamdan, the Al-Aqsa flood was a powerful, unexpected blow to the Israeli occupation. But did you anticipate the Israeli response to be this much brutal and heinous?
There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively. This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but here's the question. Was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly. It was expected that there would be a reaction, but it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you. For example, in the West Bank in 2022, before the operations, the number of martyrs was about 500. The number of wounded people who were taken to hospitals exceeded 3,000. We are talking about thousands of prisoners. Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two choices. Either you do nothing and it continues to kill you, capture you, and seize your land, or you resist and the enemy will continue the aggression. But the message will be conveyed that the Palestinian people are still adhering to their right to resist, that the enemy is paying a price for the occupation, and that in the end, this enemy will be forced to leave your land. Therefore, when you always choose resistance and you anticipate the scale of aggression and the enemy's reaction, you are convinced that this is the path that will lead to liberation.
With all the killing, destruction in Gaza, backed by the West, especially the United States, how do you plan to rebuild your popularity and also lay foundations for a new phase?
First, we start with the fact that the United States of America does not just support Israel. The United States of America is a partner in crime, a partner in genocide. It may appear to support Israel politically, but in practice, it provides ammunition, equipment, and weapons to the Zionist entity. It also employs all technological facilities in discovering tunnels and thus serves as pillars of Zionism. It is a full partner in the crime against the Palestinian people. On the other hand, when we talk about our popularity, we are not worried about it because historically the Palestinian people have always been the ones who choose resistance, and the popularity of resistance always rises. 2 months ago, various opinion polling institutions conducted an opinion poll about the popularity of the Palestinian Authority. Hamas is popular in Gaza, which was not so before the operation. Before the war, Hamas's popularity ranged between 40 to 45%. After the operation, its popularity rose. The Palestinian people saw that the resistance movement has been fighting this army for days, an army that boasted about its invincibility. People began to feel that the chances of liberation were higher than ever before, so Hamas's popularity rose. This gives us additional responsibility. How do we deal with this popularity and what serves the interest of our people to achieve national success? There is no doubt that this is a great responsibility.
Definitely it is. Now, there are propositions suggesting that Hamas is being coerced into relinquishing its leadership role in Gaza post-war amidst American and possibly Arab support, now leading to a transition to the Palestinian Authority. Now, what is Hamas's stance on these propositions, and how do you plan to particularly thwart them?
يعني دعني أوضح أولاً أن حماس لم تكن يوماً متمسكة بأن تكون هي السلطة الحاكمة.
Firstly, it is clear that Hamas was never committed to being the ruling authority. We have always adhered to a specific principle that the Palestinian people are the ones who elect and who choose their leadership through free elections. The leadership must present a program to the people that hold it accountable. Our program is clear. We resist for liberation. We won the election in 2006 and served this platform. America cannot change this fact, and we do not accept its interference in our internal affairs. We have informed all Arab countries that their interference over the Palestinian people is rejected. Whoever decides the next day in Gaza or the Palestinian people alone. This is the first part. The second part, we met with all the Palestinian factions and an agreement was reached on basic issues, including the formation of a transitional Palestinian government after the war, in which all the factions are represented and have their authority to hold elections and begin the reconstruction process. Therefore, we are not concerned about the future of the leadership of the Palestinian people, as much as we are keen for the leadership to be the one that has the option of resistance and believes in the complete liberation of Palestine.
The next question is, your objective with Operation Al-Aqsa was to shed light on the plight of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, yet the occupation has added around 10,000 new prisoners. Does Hamas still prioritize shedding light on prisoners, or is it the priority now to reach a ceasefire and to get humanitarian aid into Gaza?
Let me clarify here that the issue of prisoners was just part of the objectives of the operation and was not the primary objective of it. The main goal of the operation was to confront the project of the Netanyahu government, which announced that it would end the Palestinian issue within the next 4 years. He developed a program to seize Al-Quds and transfer ownership of real estate from the Palestinians to the Zionists, seizing the maximum level, building more settlements in the West Bank, and developed a program to bring in 1 million new settlers from outside of Palestine, Jews from all over the world, and decided to begin the process of rebuilding his relations in the region, with American support, to form a situation in which Israel appears to be a natural entity. The operation came to say that Palestine is still under occupation. The Palestinian people are still resistant. We want to liberate our land, and this is what happened. One of the results of the operation is that the prisoners will be transferred. One of the results of the operation is that the siege on the Palestinian people ends. But the essence of the process is to put the Palestinian issue on the right path.
Great. Now, if a ceasefire is agreed upon, what kind of a guarantee can there be that ensures the U.S. will comply with the terms, or the Israeli regime for that matter, especially if and when all the captives are released? Because we know when it comes to Israelis, they are not very good with being committed to their oaths and their commitments.
I agree with you that the Israelis do not abide by agreements and covenants. Their history of this is very bad. Therefore, the real guarantee is the resistance's ability to continue the confrontation with the occupation. The real guarantee is the ability of the Palestinian people to withstand. The real guarantee that we won in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood is that the Israelis and Americans began to realize that the resistance axis is capable of applying pressure to support the resistance in Gaza and is capable of having an effective influence on the political positions in favor of the resistance. Therefore, when you make an agreement, you bet on the power cards you hold, that they are the ones that can be a true guarantor of the agreement that was concluded. The occupation will try to evade or deceive, but we will also try, through the power cards we possess, to make it as disciplined as possible.
And Mr. Hamdan, speaking of negotiations and ceasefire talks, why did Hamas withdraw from the Cairo negotiations? Does the delay harm Palestinians more or the occupation?
The truth is that we did not withdraw from the Cairo negotiations. What happened was that after the Paris meeting, a proposal was presented to Hamas regarding a ceasefire and some details. This proposal was also presented to the occupation side. For us, we responded to the proposal. We proposed some modifications to it and developed our vision to improve the proposal. On the Israeli side, the mediators were surprised because Israel, which had expressed its approval of the Paris proposal, retracted parts of it. Therefore, the mediators began trying to bring Israel back to the Paris proposal. We must wait for the reaction of the mediators with the Zionist entity. From our side, there was a clear statement by our brother Ismail Haniyeh, head of the political bureau, that we deal positively with ideas that we are keen to stop the aggression, provide relief to our people and the people of the siege, and the start of reconstruction process. In exchange for all of this, we will go to the prisoner exchange process, and therefore we have clearly defined our position. We are waiting for the enemy to have a positive position. The ball is in their court and the mediator's court. We have not backed down. As long as we are negotiating, we go on with it, and as long as the fight goes on, we fight.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hamdan. And now we will continue the interview after a very short break. Okay, and now you're watching us having an interview with Mr. Osama Hamdan, the member of the political bureau of Hamas resistance movement. Mr. Hamdan, how can Hamas utilize internal pressure on Netanyahu by emphasizing the urgency of releasing prisoners in Gaza, by highlighting the significance of this issue within Israeli society and among political stakeholders? This heightened pressure may compel him to seek a ceasefire deal that aligns with Hamas's terms in order to de-escalate tensions and address the issue of prisoners effectively.
There is no doubt that in the negotiation process, you make every effort to put pressure on the enemy. One of the tools of pressure, which you also mentioned, is to the prisoner swap, what these prisoners are suffering from, and the killing that occurred to some families as a result of the Israeli Air Force's bombing of some sites. Also, some of the prisoners were killed directly by the occupation army, as happening with three soldiers who were captured by the resistance, and then the group that captured them was martyred. When they escaped, the army killed them despite identifying them. This puts great pressure on Netanyahu, but the resistance also has other tools to put pressure on Netanyahu. One of them is the resistance's unrelenting firing of rockets at some cities and regions occupied in 1948. The continuation of the resistance action on the battlefield against the occupation is putting pressure on Israel, because every day there are more deaths among the occupation soldiers and more losses among the files and ranks of the army. Just for the army, the destruction of 1,000 military vehicles out of about 4,000 military vehicles in the ground forces is very heavy. This is all a lot of pressure on Netanyahu. An important addition that should be noted is the action of the resistance in southern Lebanon, or what the Ansar Allah resistance is doing in Yemen, or the resistance in Iraq. This created pressure on the Zionist entity and also on the United States, which does not want the confrontation to expand in the region because it still believes that it can rearrange the region. The expansion of the confrontation will cause the Americans to lose control in the region, and the region will go on paths that will not necessarily be in the interest of the Americans, but rather will be in the interest of the people of the region. And this is what the Americans fear. These are all pressure cards on Netanyahu, and I believe this is the secret of the American insistence on reaching a solution that leads to a ceasefire.
Now, something about a ceasefire. Right now, the situation in Rafah. Netanyahu threatens to invade Rafah, even if a ceasefire agreement is reached. How can Hamas, you know, restrain Netanyahu's recklessness in his military options in Gaza?
When Netanyahu threatens to invade Rafah, he is seeking two purposes. The first goal is to create pressure on the resistance to give up some of its demands in the negotiations. The second one is to try to put pressure on the mediators, otherwise things will deteriorate further. We said to the mediators that any move Netanyahu makes to attack Rafah will be faced by the resistance, but it will also make Netanyahu involved in a genocide massacre. And everyone knows that the International Court of Justice issued a preliminary ruling and set conditions for it. If Netanyahu is involved in a military operation towards Rafah, this will confirm that what he is doing is genocide, and this means that he is committing a crime against humanity, and this will have repercussions not only for him, but also on the American administration, which I mentioned a little while ago that it is an accomplice in this crime. That's why we're applying confrontational pressure. I think that Netanyahu is hesitant about the Grand Operation, but if he decides to do so, things will not be easy for his army.
Now, the world sympathizes greatly with the Palestinian people, but Israelis are attempting to influence global attention. For example, by, you know, Israeli president presentation of a book titled The End of the Jews to convince the world that Hamas seeks to annihilate the Jewish population. Now, how do you respond to such displays, especially in a significant security conference like the Munich conference?
I must clarify an issue by which the Israelis and the United States are trying to put pressure on us. We do not fight the Israelis because they are Jews. We are fighting them because they are occupiers of our land. Meaning if they leave our land, we will not pursue them and we will not fight them. Our battle has a political dimension that has nothing to do with the fact that they are Jews and believe in Judaism and has nothing to do with the fact that they came to Palestine or are present in other places. The real problem is that they occupied our land. The Jewish problem as a religious one is not related to our country. Rather, the Jewish problem began in Europe. They were expelled from Britain in the 16th century, and for 200 years, Jews were banned from entering. In France, they were prevented from exercising their religious rights from 1400 AD until 1808. In Spain, they were expelled and prevented from exercising their religious rights until 1982. In Germany, we know what happened. Every time the Jews fled this persecution, they came to our Muslim country. And you know that there are Jews in all Muslim countries who live in safety. The problem rose when they decided to become an occupying force, usurp our rights, and kill our people, which prompted us to resist them. Therefore, when the Zionist chief of staff talks about the end of the Jews, he is lying and trying to make excuses for a story that we did not create and was created by the Nazis. I think the answer to it is very simple. The Zionist media published pictures of him signing the missiles that were fired to kill our people, women, and children. Therefore, I hope that he changes the title of his book to say, The End of the Occupation. Yes, the occupation will end, and we, as Muslims, will certainly be able to end it. This is our religion to embrace all people of other religions. As Palestinians, we have Muslims and Christians. No one has ever talked about a crisis between Muslims and Christians in Palestine. Rather, we lived as one nation. Therefore, yes, the occupation will end, but not on the basis that the head of the Zionist entity or the Zionist propaganda speaks about. They want to make us appear as brutal people.
Thank you. That was a very thorough explanation of the conflict between Palestinians and the Israeli regime. Now, let's talk about what's going to happen after the genocidal war in Gaza. How do you envision the end of this onslaught and now entering its fifth month without a clear ceasefire on the horizon?
لا شك أن الاحتلال أعلن عن أهداف للعملية العسكرية التي يقوم بها.
There is no doubt that the occupation announced the goals of its military operation. They announced that they want to destroy the resistance of Hamas. They want to destroy Hamas, meaning the resistance. They announced that they wanted to free the prisoners from the hands of the resistance. They announced that they wanted to form an administration for the Gaza Strip, an administration linked to the regime. After about 5 months, what happened? They failed to eliminate the resistance. The resistance on the battlefield is still fighting. Every day there are losses among the occupation army, dead and wounded. They are still held captive by the resistance. The enemy was unable to free anyone alive except for what took place according to the exchange we agreed upon. They failed in trying to create a situation in which an administration in Gaza works with the occupation. They once spoke about clans and families, and the families issued a statement saying that they were biased towards the resistance. They tried to talk about a civil administration to be imposed on the Palestinian people. The Palestinians announced that they would deal with it as agents of the regime. Therefore, they failed in all of their goals. They had only one thing left, and that was the attack on Rafah. Its result will also be a failure. The enemy will realize at some point that it is unable to succeed. The Americans realize this issue and therefore are trying to persuade the Israelis to accept a ceasefire. The regional countries that accepted the Israeli aggression began to realize that the resistance's victory would not serve the interest of the Zionists. Therefore, I believe that the chances of reaching a ceasefire agreement, even if they do not seem high so far, are now present, and we will do our best to achieve it as quickly as possible, God willing.
And Mr. Hamdan, you already mentioned the support for the Palestinian resistance by the Iraqi resistance, the resistance in Yemen and Lebanon. Now, I want to ask you, how does Hamas evaluate this support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip? Have they, you know, slowed down the pace of the onslaught in Gaza or exerted significant pressure on Israel and Americans that support them or are complicit in their crimes to impose certain options on Netanyahu?
I think there were two impacts. There is a direct impact and there is a strategic impact. The direct impact of the Resistance Act in Lebanon forced the occupation regime to keep parts of the army in northern Palestine. This means that if this confrontation had not occurred, this entire army would have launched an aggression against Gaza. And therefore, the Israeli army's ability to confront it in Gaza would have been exhausted. Also, the resistance in Lebanon succeeded in inflicting real losses and casualties on the occupation army, and the occupation army began to feel that it might fall into additional trouble if this aggression continued. The resistance in Yemen succeeded in sending a clear message. A siege on the Palestinian people means a siege on the Zionist entity. The American administration did not succeed in dealing with the matter despite its aggression against Yemen. It has been proven that this aggression did not lead to any cessation of the resistance in Yemen, represented by our brothers in Ansarullah. In Iraq, the American administration thought that the Iraqi people, after everything they had gone through and suffered from the American occupation and the injustice they suffered, might not care about issues like the Palestinian issue. The Americans were surprised that the Iraqi people began their resistance to confirm that they were with Palestine, and thus the Americans seemed to realize that they were losing and that their losses would be reflected in Israel. Strategically, I believe that the resistance action in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq achieved two goals. The first is that it sent a message that the resistance in the region is cohesive and works together in its own way and not according to what others want. Its method is effective. The second issue is that this axis has a firm, principled position and is using its capabilities in an intelligent and wise manner and is capable of achieving results. This means that the future of the region will not be according to what the United States of America or the Zionist entity wants. Rather, we are approaching a stage that the future of the region will be according to what the people of the region want. Therefore, I believe that what was achieved strategically and momentarily was important.
Okay, and the next thing I want to ask you, Mr. Hamdan, is about reports that suggest that Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh and leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip have lost contact. What is the situation now between the two? Has contact been reestablished? Or the other thing that I want to know, is there a disagreement between the two when it comes to a ceasefire?
Let me answer the second question, which is the consensus on a ceasefire. There is agreement on all the basic issues, whether between Brother Ismail Haniyeh, Brother Yahya Sinwar, or even within the political bureau of the movement. Most of the talk about internal division is rumors spread by the Zionist occupation forces, the psychological warfare organization in the occupation army, whose goal is to weaken the Palestinian front so as to make it appear as if there's a division within the resistance to affect our people or to make us comment and say that unity exists or that there is a certain thing going on which may lead to providing information to the Zionist entity that will help it reach the leadership of the resistance in Gaza. We say that the leadership decisions are made through the contribution of all members without exception. Its decision enjoys the support of all leaders of the movements in their various positions. Rather, I go further and say that we do not take these decisions, especially regarding the ceasefire, except after consulting with our brothers in the Islamic Jihad movement and in the other resistance factions, because they are also partners in sacrifice. They are our blood partners. We cannot take a decision without consulting them all.
And my final question, Mr. Hamdan, the Israeli regime is pushing ahead with its plans to invade Rafah, the southern Gaza Strip, claiming that the Israeli forces have dismantled Hamas in the northern and central Gaza. And they say Rafah and the southern Gaza Strip is the final, you know, place for Hamas resistance fighters. First of all, to what extent do you confirm these claims? And what is your message to the Israeli regime?
There is no doubt that Israel is trying to promote that it has succeeded in eliminating the resistance in the northern and central Gaza Strip. But daily facts reveal that it is lying. For example, 2 days ago, rockets were launched from the north of the Gaza Strip and from the center of the Gaza Strip, hitting cities in the Palestinian territories occupied in 1948. Israel itself announces that there have been deaths in its army in areas in the north and center, as well as the south. Now it is trying to provide justification for the attack on Rafah to create an image of victory. Therefore, we say that this lie told by the occupation cannot affect us. Israel may attack Rafah. If it does so, our message to them is simple. Rafah will only be a story of pain, suffering, and loss to the occupying army. God willing, it will be a story of heroism, victory, and sacrifice for our people and our resistance. The occupation regime will emerge more defeated and humiliated from the Battle of Rafah than what happened to it in the north-central Gaza Strip.
Thank you so much, Dr. Osama Hamdan, member of the political bureau of Hamas Resistance Movement. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be my.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Thank you for joining us in a new episode of The Last Savior. Well, 15th of Shaban is always very different and very much of a happy day. I hereby officially offer my congratulations on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi ajalallah farajah. Well, this day is a great day for all the Muslims from all around the world because it is giving us the hope for a green future, for a happy future that is going to come one day. And it gives us the hope for tolerating and for being more patient through these difficult times, because one day a savior is going to come and solve all the issues and problems, and then all the things that we've been longing for are coming to reality. So we have a guest, of course. Brother Mustafa is in here with us. Congratulations to you, brother, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me, and I would also like to offer my congratulations to you and all the listeners there for this auspicious occasion. Like you've said, it is a very, very bright day for humanity.
And it's a landmark in the Islamic calendar, actually. It would attract all the attentions to itself because it has and it holds all the hopes and all the dreams of Islamic heritage.
Right, and I think it's a hope which is we should see as being alive, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Even though our Imam is in occultation, you know, I think sometimes we sort of forget that he's there.
Exactly,
right? Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of our teachers was saying that he was saying that one of his teachers, one of his old, you know, teachers, senior teachers, would say that Imam Mahdi walks on these streets, you know, he walks among us. It's not like he's like somewhere far away or living out there, and that, you know, don't do something which would make him turn his face away from you. He even mentioned that you know, someone who had met Imam Mahdi would say to him that I can see light from different houses, right? And that light is, for example, someone who's woken up to pray Salatul Layl. But he says the other houses that people haven't woken up, they're dark, right?
Yeah.
So what that shows is that he's actually involved in our lives without us necessarily knowing it, right? And we want to be able to establish that connection with him.
Exactly.
Another teacher that I spoke to, he said, for me, his being alive is completely clear and bright. Like he says, I feel him as being alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's amazing.
I mean, you know, I think it needs a lot of practice. You have to every day devote a special time and think about it, and then make it as an integral part of your thinking and of your life to feel like. You know, about all the Ahlul Bayt, we have heard about them, and it's always a matter of wonder to us how they spoke to their believers, how they had interactions with their believers. And we always wish that we had such a condition, but we have it, and we forget about it.
Right.
The only difference is that we do not see him, but he sees us, actually.
Definitely. And, you know, establishing that connection is very much, dependent on our purity, right? The more pure we are, the easier it becomes for us to establish that kind of connection. And I know someone personally that, you know, he said that he has, for example, seen all of the 14 infallibles in their dreams. He's met all of them, right?
Yeah.
And this person is definitely exceptional and pure. But a lot of times, you know, I used to wonder, like, you know, why don't I get to meet these personalities, right? And it's taken me time to realize that I really need to, for example, work on myself to make myself much better and pure.
And that's the whole story, The purification that you talked about is very important. Without that, we cannot get into that connection that you actually mentioned. So I guess we can go for a break and then come back with the story of the birth of Imam Mahdi ajalallahu farajah.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. Well, this is The Last Savior. We're talking about the birth of Imam Mahdi ajalallahu farajah. Well, actually, the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi is a perfect day to start rehashing whatever we know about him and to go through the story of his birth and all the mysteries that are hidden in that birth and in the whole process of his existence, actually.
Right. So we know that he was born in a very difficult time where the leader of that time, the caliph of that time, he was actually trying to either kill, you know, the 11th imam, or his plan was to sort of cut off the lineage of imamate, right? Mm-hmm. So that there's no more imams being born. And they say one of the miracles that occurred at that time was that the wife of Imam Hassan Askari, when she was pregnant, it didn't show up. Like, you know, normally when a woman is pregnant, you can see that, you know, the stomach is
getting bigger, by time.
Now, I would say as a miracle, that didn't show up for her, for example.
In order to save the child.
In order to save the child. Because if they suspected that she's pregnant, they would have automatically either killed her or they would have killed the child at
exactly,
birth.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And then we see there's a lot of miracles which accompanied, for example, the birth, right? We're told, for example, there was light from heaven.
Just for the record, actually, sorry to interrupt you, they were living in a restricted era. So they had people to watch over them. So it was not an easy life.
Right, right. They were always under supervision.
Yeah.
You know, there was always spies that were spying on them. So that was they were living in extremely difficult conditions. Now, one of the interesting miracles that I recently learned about is that Imam Mahdi, he spoke at birth, right? Mm-hmm. He sort of testified to God's existence and many other things. For me, this sort of the similarities, for example, between his birth and the birth of Prophet Isa, I'm starting to like see similarity. And even in their lives, you can see their similarities in the sense that they're both still alive. They're both going to come back and save humanity.
Exactly.
And they both, for example, spoke at birth, right? Mm-hmm. So that is another sort of interesting part of their births, right? And then, of course, we see that, you know, after the imam's birth, soon after them, you know, he was taken into occultation to save his life. And that's because, you know, we see the history of the imams, one after the other, they were killed, right? And that's one of the reasons we were told that the 12th imam was taken to occultation, is to save his life. Otherwise, he would have also been killed.
So, well, there is some, just as you were making a comparison between him and the Prophet Isa, there is something interesting about her mother as well, because she was a Roman girl.
Yes, she was a Roman girl. She was Christian, by the way. And I think it's reported that she was among the descendants of the companions of Hazrat Isa.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And, you know, I believe before the marriage, before her marriage to Imam Hassan Askari, she was given the news in her dream, you know.
Exactly,
that
yeah.
You will marry this person, that you'll have a birth, you know, these kind of things. It's actually a really good movie that Iran has made, The Princes of Rome.
Exactly, yeah. That's very beautiful. It's an animation, actually.
Right. So I would definitely encourage people to go and watch it if they haven't. I believe it's available in English now, is it?
I don't know, but for sure there must be a subtitle.
I think there's subtitles, yeah. If it's not out in English, then subtitles. I know it's out in like Urdu and like some other maybe
but
languages.
But that's very nice and amazing. So at this time, let's go for a change of mood for a break and then we'll be back.